honestly, like, some students, like my other classmates, like, they just had to study and do their work. I had to deal with ignorance, with prejudice, with, you know, racial slurs on top of studying. You know, it was a lot of emotional stress.
That was a segment from Black on Campus One, featuring my guest, Sophie, a nurse who graduated from U Ottawa and experienced a wide variety of overt and covert racism while on campus. On this episode of Black Girl Galaxy, I will still be focusing on the Black student experience at predominantly white universities and colleges, speaking to my sister Osaru, who is a senior at Queen's University and founded the first Queen's Black Pre-Medical Association, with the goal of encouraging Black students on their way to becoming doctors. We talk about the micro and macro aggressions that we both faced, and discuss infamous events like the Queen's Racist Party, the Black Medical Student Ban, and how these schools create a culture that is not safe for Black women. I am very excited to get into this episode because I hope that it will lead to real change on campuses. So without further ado, let's take off.
Taking off to Black Girl Galaxy in 3, 2, 1, blast off.
So before I talk to my sister, as always, I want to talk about white supremacy and how it's influenced the ways in which Black women move through the education system in Canada. Despite what is commonly held true, Canada is 100% a country that was founded on white supremacy and the patriarchy. Women's rights, like the right to vote, the right to receive an education, and equitable pay, have always been fought for. However, what we see is that the fight was often for white women, and the solutions that were built to help women and elevate their status in society were often built with white women in mind. For example, in 1916, when women were given the right to vote, that definition of what it meant to be a woman was anchored on whiteness, as Black, Asian, and Indigenous women didn't receive this right until years later. I call upon this because I think it's telling. We know that women face barriers within education and other institutions, but we often don't focus on how much greater those barriers become when intersected with Blackness. The right to vote was only given to women who had ownership of taxable property. So while many white women had generational wealth and access to opportunities to allow them to own property and therefore vote, Black women often didn't have access to the same opportunities. So even after they were given the right to vote, years after white women were given that right, they still couldn't vote. So this is what happens when Black women and racialized women are excluded from the solutioning in these mechanisms and interventions and programs that are really targeted at elevating the status of women in society. It's often cowering or leaning towards building a solution for white women because we're not considered as a part of the problem. And examples of this can be seen within education. As more and more opportunities were developed and given to women, they were often designed with white women in mind and opened up to marginalized groups as an afterthought. Thinking back to my experience in primary school, I remember learning about what was accomplishable by women. And this is one of the efforts that was meant to encourage us, to make us think outside of the Disney princesses that we all aspire to be. Which, honestly, I see nothing wrong with that. I still want to be a Disney princess. But again, most of the women that we were learning about were white women, you know, Doris Anderson, Emily Carr, and it wasn't until later in life and through my own exploration that I learned about figures like Viola Desmond and Mary Shad Carey. Like many other Black girls within the Canadian education system, I was plagued with notions of sexual stereotypes and perceptions of low educational aspirations and achievements. And you know, I was fortunate enough to receive forceful encouragement, as I will call it, from my parents who expected nothing else but academic excellence in school. So, like many other Black girls, I tried to push uphill, to jump over the barriers where I could, but this is laborious for Black girls. School should be a place of learning, regardless of socioeconomic status or race, where girls gather the requirements necessary to build themselves a better future. So when we think about trying to encourage girls on their route to education, we have to look back into the policies, the interventions, and the protocols put in place to help propagate women. Who are they focusing on? Is it centered on whiteness? Because in my experience, they often have been. So beyond the university and college experiences, Black women face barriers at every level of education, from increased suspension rates, being placed in lower achieving academic streams based on racist justifications and not merit, and being excluded from literature, from our textbooks, from the inspirational stories used in Canadian classrooms. So what this amalgamates to is around a 5% difference between women who are not visible minorities who hold university degrees and Black women who hold university degrees. And some might say that 5% is not that much, but when you're thinking about the Black women that it represents, the young Black girls who should be, you know, diploma and degree holders, but because of a system riddled with challenges and barriers and solutions that were meant to decrease those barriers being primarily designed for white women, they don't have the same opportunities to become degree holders. So that 5% is very important, and I hope that this episode can do something to help bridge that gap. And we need more women and Black women to get degrees, not just for, you know, my benefit, but for the benefit of society. Black women for too long have had to elbow their ways into boardrooms and creative spaces and classrooms, which severely limit our ability to make positive impact to this world. And you know what? Beyond the benefit that it will serve everyone else, Black women have a right to attend institutions that are equitable simply because they are human and it's their right. So I want to talk to my sister Osaru, who is very passionate about work in this space and is a student at Queen's University, about the barriers that we had to overcome in the public school system to gain acceptance into a predominantly white university, where Black women still have huge hurdles to jump over and break through on our humble pursuit of education. Osaru, hello, my lovely sister. How are you?
Hello. Hi.
You sound so drained.
I just woke up.
Gotcha. Cool. It's 3:46 in the afternoon. So
I woke up from a nap.
No, it's all good. Get your self-care in. I'm not judging you a lot. That's fine. Whatever. Would you like to let the people know, you know, what school you go to, what program you're in?
Sure. I am doing a life science specialization at Queen's University.
Nice. Awesome. And when you sort of found out that you were going to Queen's, what did that process look like for you? How did you feel when you found out and fully accepted your offer? And knowing that Queen's was a predominantly white school, did that have any sort of effect on your excitement once you found out that you were going to be starting up with life science at Queen's?
When I was researching universities, Queen's became my top choice. I was just really excited about the school as a whole. I think I was told, like, oh, that Queen's is a really white school, but something I was really focusing on or knew too much about, and or any of the negative histories and just like culture on campus. I wasn't really focusing on that. So I was just excited about everything. And I was just really happy when I got accepted and when I accepted the offer.
Yeah, I think I had a very, almost like a very similar experience when I got accepted into Western. A lot of people were like, oh, my school's white. And I was like, okay, like, so is this high school. Like, like, that's cool. I could probably go there and find, you know, a community. It'll be fun. And then you sort of get to Western or Queens and you're like very excited and you're pumped. You're like moving into residence. And I think it's like day two, or maybe it took me too long. It probably should have been minute two, that I was like, man, there's like no Black people here. Like, hold on, where are they at? Because I haven't seen one. Like, when is your second day and you haven't seen a Black person? Like, you start to think, like, what's really going on? And that's when it starts to hit you that everyone who was like, oh, but that's a white school, like, they really genuinely meant it, that it's like a predominantly white school. But anyways, so here we are. We already went to the schools. And if we're thinking back to your first couple of moments at Queen's or your first couple of classes,
when did you start to really realize that, you know, there were far fewer, you know, diverse students or students of color at Queens?
So like, the experience, I guess you just said, was definitely not my experience. I went there and my excitement just, it lasted a long time. I guess I just became fully involved in all the orientation activities, and I was excited to start classes. So I didn't become disillusioned for a while. I never had a sudden moment of, oh, what is this institution? It was just slowly. I guess I started to notice that it's not only whites. There are a lot of different backgrounds represented here, but there are very, very few Black people. So I started to notice that, I guess, near the end of first year, and really started noticing in second year, where I was just kind of looking in my classes, and as classes got smaller, I was like, kind of like, oh, I'm literally the only Black person in this class, or it's just like, I can only think of 10 in my whole program. My program's large. It's one of the largest programs in the school. So it's like, yeah, I started to realize that's not really, there's not a lot of Black people here.
Yeah, I don't even think I counted, which is, that's how low. I mean, when you can count, then you know it's pretty low. But I just knew it was just so few and far between that it was definitely like under five. Like, it's a handful of people within my program. When I went, I didn't even say I went to Western University for 5 years. I did 3 years in health sciences and then 2 years at the Ivy School of Business. And in my 3 years of health sciences, I was able to find, you know, Black friends within the program, to be able to build that community. But that was something that took me until like middle of my second year to really lay that foundation of like strong Black female friends around me. And I think during the time, like you said, you weren't disillusioned. I wasn't 100% disillusioned. I was just sort of like, how can I just make the best of this situation and sort of try to find people to hang out with and to study with and to go to bars with. And I think a lot of that stemmed from the people I lived with, who again happened to be white women, and my floor was very much so predominantly white, and trying to just, you know, not blend in, because you can't really blend in and I wouldn't want to, but just trying to fit into a social culture around me, because it's not just like you're going to school for 5 hours a day and then you get home and you're a part of your family unit and your community. You go to school and then come back and live within residence. So like, your entire ecosystem is filled with 60,000 students, many of whom are not people of color. So that's something that, you know, for a long time, I just sort of accepted as a reality of my situation and tried to make the best of it. But I think you have certain incidents that bring you out of that illusion and sort of remind you that the situation that you're in is not normal to, or not something that you're used to being in, and not seeing people who look like you will eventually take a toll, whether that's something that you're super hyper aware about or something that happens almost subconsciously. But I think for a lot of Black students, it is something that can take a toll on them. So Queens, I think, has a lot of controversies associated with race relations, with you know, students respecting and appropriating other cultures. I'm wondering if you can speak a bit about that, because that this is something that, you know, took place while you were a student. You still are a student, but happened while you were a student at Queens.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversial things that happen here, and it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that they happen, and it's unfortunate that people only think of that when they think of Queens. But at the same time, I don't want to say, oh, don't think of these things. This is not Queens, but because it is. It's a part of, like, it's what happens when you come here. And if you're, you know, a numerical minority racial group, then it's like, that's something that might affect you. Right? You can't just like lie about it. But yeah, so it does happen. It's unfortunate. There's things that happened before I came to Queens that I just didn't know about. And the first like major like egregious incident that happened was when I was in first year, not too long into the year. So it didn't take very long. I think it was, it was Halloween. So October, second month I was here. And a bunch of students decided to have a racist costume party where they literally just went as other races. So they had a racist party. They dressed up as like monks and Rastafarians and just like very, very,
it's ridiculous.
It was just, very, very bad. And I didn't know that it happened when it did happen. So I was just like chilling in my room. I think I was working and like an upper year student that I was connected, with texted me and she was like, you know, I know this might be kind of hard right now on campus like, with everything that's happening and like with tension that's on campus. If you need any support, I'm here for you. And I was just like, what are you even talking about? I don't remember if I asked her what she was talking about, but I just know I had no idea what she was talking about.
In 2016, a group of Queens students thought it would be a great idea to host a race party where mostly white students dressed up as Buddhist monks, as black people in prison jumpsuits, and as Mexicans in sombreros. They even made it into a competition, assigning a country to different teams with the ultimate goal of winning $75 for best group costume. It was kind of like a racist Olympics. And this event was very similar to a fictional TV show, Dear White People, where a similar party was thrown.
Dear white people, here's a list of acceptable Halloween costumes. A pirate, slutty nurse, any of our first 43 presidents. Top of the list of unacceptable costumes, me.
And in the show, it sparked outrage just as it did in real life. You know, student groups began to mobilize, the president came out and condemned the party and called for an overall change to campus culture. However, there were still pockets of students who were defending the party, claiming that they did nothing wrong and that including this in the definition of racism was actually offensive to victims of racism, which that's an actual quote from a Queen student who I'm assuming attended the party. So, while a large majority of people, you know, do believe that this was a racist act because it was in a form of appropriation, because I don't know what else you call reducing cultures and ethnic groups to the most basic stereotypes, and to claim that you are black because you're in a prison jumpsuit. I mean, the only answer that I can think of is racism. Now, I know that this is just a small group of students, but we know small groups of students have the ability to cause harm for vulnerable and underrepresented people on campus, just like they did when they threw this party. The question, though, that's really prominent in my mind is, what happened to these students? You know, were any repercussions taken? Was anyone suspended? Were people reprimanded? You know, would there have been this reaction if this party was advocating for sexual misconduct instead of racism? And I'm a management consultant, so I always try to look for similarities in previously implemented strategies and think about how they have helped solve a problem in one area and how it could potentially be applied to a problem that I'm facing. So when I think back to my first year in school and the following years in which I was a student advisor, I think about all the training programs and the emphasis that was placed on sexual violence. And the reason for the emphasis is because, unfortunately, one in four women attending universities or Canadian colleges will be sexually assaulted by the time they graduate. And universities and colleges have done a tremendous amount of work in the last decade to develop educational materials, to put in place prevention mechanisms, increase monitoring at residences, multiple channels in which students can report sexual violence, and prominent promotional materials advocating against this type of violence. What's most important, though, is that they also increased the penalties for sexual misconduct and made it their business to expel, reprimand, and suspend students who broke the rules and committed sexual acts of violence. Now, was this response perfect? Has it eradicated sexual assault on campus and across the country? Unfortunately, no.
But what it's done is showcase the stance on the matter, that this is not tolerated in any shape or form on a college or university campus. It has also caused top-of-mind awareness for students, so they are better able to recognize instances of assault, and most importantly, it's made it easier for women and victims of assault to come forward. This change just didn't happen sporadically. You know, like, many universities took this issue on because of serious public and student pressures, people demanding that universities do more, and data collection that made it impossible for them to deny the problem. So we have to do the same now. And it's not to say that issues of sexual violence are lesser or should be de-emphasized, absolutely not. And I don't think universities are nailing it either, but they're doing better. And while perhaps my viewpoint that universities can be perfect utopias is slightly naive, I still think that they can be better. And I think that they can do better for Black students and do more for Black women. They can take this problem on head first. Use the money that we're saving on in-person classrooms, if we even are, I'm not really sure what the COVID costs are, but redirect funds into inclusion and diversity. Allocate more time and more energy to this problem. Just overall do better. And if you think you've reached a good enough point, you have to do more. Because according to thousands of people of color who attend Canadian universities and colleges, what's being done now is simply just not good enough. It's not good enough to simply release a statement condemning a party in which hundreds of students were clearly showcasing racism, and that causes psychological harm for the people of color who attend these universities. And universities are meant to protect their students from harm.
Mm-hmm. And when you come here to a university that, even though it's not perfectly diverse, like there's not an even mix of representation of different backgrounds, the school still tries to promote a message of acceptance and inclusivity. So I believe that that is frustrating for some people when they see that, oh, like this school is predominantly white, why do we have to care about Indigenous and Black students? That's just me putting thoughts and words into other people's minds and mouths. I don't know. But I know that when I was in third year and I was a residence don for the first time, a don in my building worked really hard on this poster display that she put up along the main staircase. It was really beautiful. It was like this collage of Halloween costumes, and she basically said, like, these are inclusive costumes that are, you know, eccentric but not offensive. And then she also put examples of non-inclusive costumes that are very offensive, and somebody ripped it up and it basically spread the shreds all over the lobby. And I was just like, are you serious? Like, that offended somebody so, like,
to the point of rage.
Yeah. Telling someone not to be racist, you're like, how dare you? You know? And then they, I don't know what causes people to take so much offense by that. Some people look at that and they're like, yeah, that's right. You don't have to listen.
Cool.
Yeah, you don't have to listen to it. And then other people are like, how dare you tell me what it to do? I'm going to rip this down, as if, like, one of them is obviously clearly more damaging and worse, you know? But I don't think that putting it up is damaging anyways. And a similar thing happened to me in my fourth year. I was donning in a different building, and we have Black History Month displays that are put up, and it was the end of Black History Month, so the last day was like February 28th or 29th, I think this year is a leap year. And when I woke up on, you know, the first of the next month, I woke up to the Black History Month display being torn down.
Wow.
And I was pissed off. Like, I think I put it up, you know, like,
not only was that racist, I also put that up.
I was like, nah. So I literally put it back up, and I taped it up, and I put way more tape on it this time. it was like stapled and retaped, and I was there like playing music in the lobby, putting it up, and people were walking past me and they're very uncomfortable, and I think I know who did it, but whatever, let me not get too much into it. But so I put it back up, and
let me know who they are so I can find them.
No. And it stayed up for a while. So I think it stayed up for the rest of the semester. This is winter 2020 semester, and you know, our semester was cut short, but it did stay up. So I think that the night that it got torn down, there were a bunch of students frolicking around this the building, being very disruptive and who were drunk. And I think when you mix alcohol with this sense of freedom, but and then also they are offended by messages of, you know, empowerment of
Black people,
groups who were, yeah, Black people,
groups Black people
who
were
oppressed, you know, yeah, just like the groups who have been oppressed, it just makes them angry. And then when you combine that, they tear down displays. I still, like, that's still me putting, like, just trying to justify like how they were brought to do that, but who really knows what motivates people and why they decide to, you know, inflict pain on their community.
And it's kind of like a million, at least for me, like these things, and maybe that incident affected you, and like you said, you were upset and angry, but none of those things are like, or any incidents that I've had of racist encounters were enough to make me be like, this is sick. I'm tired of this. Like, there's so much racism here. But it was almost like a million tiny cuts that by the time I'd left university, I was like, wow, I'm actually pretty like damaged and traumatized a little bit from what happened. I'm sure my therapist would say a lot of it from what happened during my time. And it's like, you see a poster of Martin Luther King torn down, and maybe that affects you and you're like, that's fucked up, whatever, but you just pick it up, staple it back on, and you try to go about your day because you're still a student trying to accomplish something, trying to get a degree. And it's not until I think I left university that I realized that there were so many incidents. Like, when you start to actually think about it and reflect, there are so many incidents of microaggressions. And I would say that like the pulling down of the posters are for sure macroaggressions, but microaggressions of people being racist towards me, doing things that made me feel very uncomfortable, but it was never enough in the moment for me to, you know, speak up, to be enraged, to do something, and to try to change anything in particular about that incident. So I'm wondering, in your experience at Queens, what kind of microaggressions did you go through, and how did that affect, or how is that affecting you still as you're still a student there?
Yeah. You know me, you know that from the beginning of my journey of accepting and, you know, and fully embracing and loving and expressing my Blackness has always been closely tied to my hair.
Yeah.
So that's as I am, you know, developing in who I am and like claiming my space, standing my ground, my hair is always a part of that. Mm-hmm. So even when I wasn't very active or let's just say not extremely into the practice of making myself aware and learning about issues and seeing how I can help it or contribute to empowerment in any small ways, I've always been trying to, like, you know, express myself through my hair. Mm-hmm. So in first year, when I was still naive, I was still like rocking my natural hair.
Not or naive, natural hair still stuff. Hadn't learned yet.
Yeah, naive.
Okay.
When I was like rocking, I was still, but at that time I was still rocking my natural hair. I'm like, nah, this is something like that I'm going to do for myself. Mixed with just different styles, right? So I'd have straight hair, braids, natural hair, just like having a time. And people were just like uncomfortable by my own hair, which I don't understand it.
Yeah.
And so, like, I remember in second year when I lived in a house with my housemates, I wasn't fully comfortable with, like, you know, just taking care of my hair and having it out and doing treatments every now and then, just because I would get so many questions. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, I was going to say, I know it's not malicious, but who really knows? Because some of the questions, it's just like, I remember like one of my favorite pastimes is just to relax and like watch YouTube. So I was watching YouTube in the family room and Jackie Aina was just, you know, I don't know, I was talking about something and she had her natural hair out and she has blonde hair. And then my housemate said, who has a blonde afro? And I was like, a lot of people. And it was silent.
Blonde.
And then it was silent. And then she left the room. And I'm just like, I thought about that since then a lot. I'm like, what she really meant to say is like, it's weird. Well, she said it. She said it very clearly. It's weird to have a blonde afro. Black hair should not be dyed blonde. Mm. Where she herself, she has naturally dark black hair, and she was thinking about dyeing it blonde or like or gray. And I'm just like, that is very like racist thing to say. It's like you're saying it's unacceptable for black people to change their hair because of what, their skin tone, because it's obviously not because of the hair. It's because the hair is in an afro, as she mentioned.
Like blonde hair is reserved for non-black people.
Yeah, or at least people who just don't, like who have straight hair, whose hair doesn't naturally, you know, form an afro or form puffs. So it's like,
yeah, because I'm sure she's never questioned Beyonce's blonde hair, but now that you put it in afro,
maybe
it's like, what's all this?
Yeah. So that was just like a little thing. And then just, I guess there's always little things. And if I were to really, really think about it, I would just keep going on.
I think, yeah, of course, because there's a million incidents. And when I was trying to reflect back on the times in which I'd experienced microaggressions, just sort of as a random thought experiment at 2 a.m. one day, one of the first incidents I'd realized where I'd experienced, you know, microaggressions and racism so blatantly, but I wasn't able to fully, you know, contextualize it or to take it as seriously as it should have been taken, was when my roommate on the second day of me meeting her was like, hey, there's this guy who plays on the soccer team and she played on the women's soccer team and I think he'd be great for you. And like, he's really obsessed with me. He loves me so much. Everyone can tell that he's like super into me, but I definitely don't think that we'd be a match or like we would work out. Like I think she was dating someone at the time, but wasn't really presenting him as not an option because she was in a relationship, but because he was black, and said to me blatantly, I think if I took him home, my parents would literally flip out. And I'm black. Like, I'm sitting right in front of you. And you're literally saying, if I had taken a partner home who looks like you, my parents would flip out. And it's like, wow, for one, you and your racist parents have a lot of evaluation work to do, where you're looking at people's skin color and that is an immediate disqualification from a life partner. And like, I understand that people have their own preferences of like what they're attracted to, like who they see themselves marrying and dating and things like that. But this was really blatant, right? Like this was, I can't take this person home who is, you know, in a top program at a very good university, has a full scholarship on the soccer team, you know, like is very charismatic. I could never take that person home to my parents. They'd flip out. And it's like,
because he's black.
And I remember thinking like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe your parents would flip out, like that's pretty fucked up, like because he's black, like interesting, whatever. But this is my second day and this is someone I have to live with. Like in that moment I didn't feel, and I wish I could go back and tell first year me to buck up and be like, hell fucking no, like you push more, you ask more questions, you showcase, you try to, and I don't think it is the job of black people in any way, shape or form to educate people, to, you know, have conversations about race with non-black people. I really don't think it's by no means your obligation, but just for the rage and just for the fact that we had to live together, I wish I could have gone back and been like, that's really interesting that you think your parents would flip out. Do you think it's because they hold negative perceptions of Black people? Question mark. And just to see what that answer would have been. And I realized I had so many incidents like that in my 4 years, 4 or 5 years at Western, in which I wish I would have said something and prompted more and really tried to uncover what the true meaning of what people were saying. But in those moments, I didn't feel empowered enough. I didn't always recognize it. And I think this is something that happens a lot when people leave school, is they realize that they went through a lot, but they never took
the time to express.
Yeah.
You know, when I was researching universities, one of the things that I did to kind of know the vibes of a school was I would go and like watch their YouTube videos and just like the different videos and campaigns they did. And I remember I watched a video series from Western. Mm-hmm. It was Letter to My First Self. And literally a Black guy said, my first year self. Mm-hmm. He said, like everyone else's statements or messages they would say to their first year selves were very, you know, applicable to anybody. Like, you know, like, oh, study, like, you can get through it. But his was like very specific to being Black. And he was like, you know, someone says something racist to you, you should just say it. And I was just like, what? I wasn't like, what? But I was kind of just a little bit surprised. Like, I didn't expect that. I'm like, he experienced like people saying racist things to him. I'm like, man, that's unfortunate. And that wasn't why I didn't go to Western at all. But like, it's like something that just happens to, I don't want to say everybody, but like definitely 99%.
Yeah.
Of like Black people who go to predominantly white universities. And I think that when you do experience a microaggression or a macroaggression, and the fact that you don't say anything adds more pain to it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, in my opinion or in my experience, so it's like, this person is racist and they've offended me. Mm-hmm. And then I wasn't like, you know, like strong enough or like quick enough to like, you know, call them out for it. So it's like, it makes you feel even worse that you just kind of like took it. Mm-hmm. Which I know is a toxic way of thinking, because you can't like
go back and change that situation. Yeah, you have to learn from it.
It's not even about going back. Like, I think it's a toxic way of thinking, because that's like a lot to ask of yourself, like when you are surprised or caught off guard or you know, saddened by something, that you have to combat it. I think that that you should cut yourself some slack. Like, someone was literally like racist or rude to you. Yeah. Like, when you think of little kids being bullied on like on a playground, like, you don't think of, how could you let that happen to you? Like, you know, like, fight them back. It's like,
beat them up now.
Yeah. We automatically understand that they, like, something bad is happening to them, and like, you know, it's hard. So I don't know, when
in a situation where you feel safe.
Unfortunately, very, very, very much unfortunately, it's with experience and time. Like, when it's happened to you enough and it starts to not catch you off guard anymore, which is like, you've probably gone through, like, you know, you have to heal from the damages that it has already caused, so that you're now in a place where you're like, interesting that you just said that. Can you please elaborate on why you thought it was okay to say that to me? Like, stuff like that. You know, you just got to cut yourself a little bit of slack.
And it's, you know what? And you're so wise. That's why I bring you on here. because you're not always in a situation where you feel safe. When I was originally sourcing, you know, stories from Black women who've gone to predominantly white universities, when I was making this episode, a lot of the stories, at least from Western, that I received were, I was at a nightclub and a guy comes up to me and is like, I wanna...
Hey, chocolate mama.
Yeah. You know... You know, I'm sorry. It's so funny. You know that one meme where it's like Tanner with his arm over the pool, and he's just like black girls rock. Am I right? I'm Tanner. Like, I can't remember the specific meme, but it's hilarious, and it's exactly sort of like that. It's like, hey, dark princess, like. Mm-hmm. I've never been with a black girl before. Like, I want to be with you. You know, like, oh, like, yeah, like, I want to knock this off. And like, it wasn't one person who said this to me. There are several people who are like, I felt very unsafe in sexual encounters with men because they were fetishizing me. And right off the bat, you're in a situation when you're vulnerable. It's nighttime. You're probably drunk and someone is coming up to you saying racist things. And a lot of them were like, I just sort of like, some of them were like, I proceeded, you know, to engage with them. Most of them were like, I immediately stopped or backed away or felt shit about myself and went home and like cried or whatever. But you're not empowered in that moment, especially when there's that power dynamic to be like, hey, that was racist, you know, like you are a racist and I'm defending myself in this moment. Because like you said, not everyone, you know, are easily equipped with clapbacks, you know, not everyone is able to ask the questions that helps to showcase the racism in what happened. And it is through time, and it is unfortunate, as you said, that we have to learn these things, but it's also very cyclical and like, it's not, and it's very fluid. Like, you're never going to be to a point where every single racist incident that happens to you, you're able to defend yourself, you're able to educate, you're able to, you know, eliminate that from happening altogether. But there will be times where you feel empowered enough and you speaking up and you defending yourself and you, you know, showcasing how something that someone did or said to you was wrong could actually make you feel a lot better about that interaction, right? So you don't walk away feeling just the feelings of despair, just the feelings of, you know, and or even starting to internalize some of the things that people have said to you. But I think those instances aren't as common as they should be, and it's for a number of reasons, whether you feel comfortable with that confrontation, whether you feel safe enough to speak up and vocalize those thoughts. But I think as more people learn, as more Black people, quote unquote, get woke to these instances, hopefully there are more clapbacks or slapbacks. I'm a person who doesn't believe in violence, but there's limits. So I guess, microaggressions, like they're inescapable at these types of universities.
So we started a pre-med society in my second year. It's the Black Pre-Medical Association. And our aim was just to educate the general pre-med community about the importance of inclusivity and diversity in medicine. It literally contributes to better patient outcomes and just like increase feelings of safety for patients and doctors who are not white. So that was number one, but our main goal, that was number two. And our main goal of the club was to create a safe community for Black pre-med students and connect them to resources that will help them be successful in their journey to medicine, because we ourselves, we wanted to contribute to diversifying that field because we know that it would be so important. Like, it's just, there's been so many things historically that are just have skewed the population of people in medicine.
In 1918, Queen's University banned Black students from enrolling in its medical school, and the 15 Black students who attended the school were strongly encouraged to leave. The justification behind the ban was that it was to improve the school's reputation with the AMA, the American Medical Association. The AMA provided ratings for medical schools, not only in the States, but also in Canada. And they stated that Black students would be better off studying basic hygiene practices rather than medicine. And it wasn't just at Queen's.
I know I'm picking on them a lot in this episode, and slightly deservingly so, but McGill, Dalhousie, and U of T placed restrictions on Black students at one point or another. It wasn't until 1965 that Black students were again able to enroll into the medical school. It's incredibly jarring, at least to me, to know that this wasn't taken off the books until 2018. And even though obviously the ban was not enforced, it still took almost 100 years to officially repeal the law. It is important to unpack our history and to teach it, because these things have real-life consequences, such as Black women today having substantially higher premature births than white women, and how they face biases in the healthcare system that they do not feel pain in the same ways that white people do. Perhaps if there were more Black doctors and more Black leaders in the field of medicine, this wouldn't be a reality today, and more Black women would survive medical procedures. But the active and deliberate exclusion of Black people in education is a historical lever that is pulled to ensure that white spaces are protected. And we have an obligation to look at policies and protocols that still may be formally or informally in place today. They may not outright ban Black students from attending these institutions, but they may make it a hell of a lot harder for them to get in, and the barriers extend beyond the application process.
Mm-hmm. That have just contributed to kind of creating, you know, this idea that it's just not accessible for people who are not, like, white and come from a family where they're, you know, physicians in their family. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of our programs, it was called White Coat Black Doctor, a neonatal physician. I believe she's a neonatal surgeon, was invited and was giving a talk about her experience in medicine. Mm-hmm. And she was the on-call physician, and she was called to attend to a patient matter. And when she came to the floor, somebody's like, oh, well, like, literally, this sounds like it's out of a movie. They're like, oh, like, the mop is over there or whatever, like, because you're obviously here to clean. And it's just like, and she said that she just brushed it off.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I guess you kind of have to, like, and that's the thing. That's, like, that's also another level. Like, when you're in a professional environment, like, it's seen as now unprofessional to defend yourself in these situations. Mm-hmm. So it's like, so if I'm going to, you know, stand here and, you know, defend my rights and not let you dehumanize me, I'm unprofessional. So basically you're creating the idea or the culture of just, like, taking it and then brushing it off, remaining professional, and, you know, continuing doing your work as if everything's fine. But then now, something that I know well, just because of the work that I'm involved in on campus, when you try to take different routes for action and reporting acts of discrimination, it's just very frustrating. It's hard to, there's, like, almost a waste of your time sometimes. I hate to say that because I do want people to take action formally.
Yeah,
when these things happen. But sometimes it's just like they're trying to, you know, make you believe that what they're doing is enough when all they're basically telling you is sorry and nothing actually happens. And it's just like, they need to do better at protecting Black students and professionals. And one of those ways is diversifying the, you know, the pool of students, of faculty. And that's something that's, like, the demographic makeup of an institution is something that's so deeply ingrained. Like, it's not something that happens overnight. Like, Queens is majority white faculty members for a very specific reason. Like, that's the way it started out. So it is not just gonna change overnight. So, you know, I rambled a little bit, but
no, it was good.
Definitely, for sure, you face problems with being Black in academia, and as you progress in your career, the challenges present themselves in different ways, unfortunately.
So I wanted to know a bit more about some of the work that or some of the things that you've been pushing your university to do. I know you're quite vocal in meetings with leadership, and you're not afraid to raise your hand and ask questions. How have you been pushing the university, or what are some things that you've been questioning them about?
So one council that I'm part of is called UCARE, which is the Undergraduate Council on Anti-Racism and Equity. Mm-hmm. So, well, that council is made up of a lot of people, board representations, alumni, undergrads, and graduates. And being a part of it, I was really excited. Like when I first was elected into my seat, I was very excited. Mm-hmm. And then I unfortunately slowly realized that this is not just a committee that a department in any random department had decided to create. This is like the council for the university that was created by the top leaders of the school. Mm. And they said, our mission statement is to monitor Queen's progress on anti-racism and just, pushing the EDII agenda.
EDII,
and
which is?
Yeah, equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigeneity. Mm-hmm. So I'm here, like, I'm going to be a part of initiatives that make this school better, but it's very frustrating that this high-level council is still mainly just talking.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, we have meetings, and the people on the council are very motivated. I'm not going to at all like demean them. We're mm-hmm. very motivated to actually have cause some change on campus, but we do our research, we do our data collection and analyses, and give recommendations, and it's up to the board to now decide mm-hmm. if they're going to take recommendations and actually, you know, elicit these changes. And mm-hmm. and some have been accepted, but not all. And at our last meeting, a point that I really wanted to get across to the principal was, we say that, oh, Queens, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement over the summer, mm-hmm. Queens is taking a step to look at itself, reevaluate, and make change, is what they're basically saying. And this change is going to be radical. And I hope that it is. But then I ask, what are we going to do specifically mm-hmm. for accountability? And what are we going to do to start a culture shift on campus, you know, away from the culture that being racist is wrong, but it's acceptable because there are no consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are we going to do to make people stop feeling like they're in this bubble, and where everyone, like, because most people around them are white, it's okay to, you know, push the white agenda, mm-hmm. you know, just like, how are we going to shift that culture on campus? What are we going to do to increase accountability? And I obviously, it's a gray area, right? Because we're not meant to police thought, and we don't want to turn into like this police state of there's no freedom and no speech and people feeling, I don't know, unsafe here, which is kind of ironic to say, because people feel unsafe here because of, you know, the inaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, what are we going to do to like kind of, you know, make it less gray, you know, unblur the line of where we stand? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, yeah, it's a blurry and we can't tell people what to do, but we still have to take a you know,
you still have to do something.
Yeah, you have not just do something, but you, after a point, you have to say, this is our school, this is what we believe.
Yeah.
And you have to stand in that position. You know, you can't just be like, everything is okay, you know. You have to create a set of values and stand by it. And, you know, and if that influences who comes to the university, then it's working, because you're trying to create a place that is safe. And basically what I was met with from the principal, he was like saying that it's just a hard thing to do. And it's a hard thing to, when we say consequences and mandatory training and agreements, it's like, it's just a very hard thing to do. But that's basically all I heard. I never heard of what they're doing about it. Like, yes, it's hard, but how are you planning on overcoming this hard thing?
Like, what's step one? What's step two?
Yeah.
Like, what's step three? Of course, it's a mountain, but what are we going to do to help climb it, to help get to that end state where we're creating a safe and inclusive environment?
So that's what I was met with in that moment. Though in general, you know, statements have been released over the past months describing that as an institution, they're going to basically operate from a place of inclusion, and there's going to be a lot of change. And I hope there is. And you can't be naive to think that, you know, it's going to happen next year or anything, because to actually have create a culture shift, it's something that's going to, it's going to take a while.
Yeah, I agree. And I think as long as you and other students continue to push and continue to do your best, we'll start to see change. I think what we also have to do now, especially given the momentum of the anti-Black racism movement, is to start asking universities, you know, don't tell me that you're sorry and you're listening. Tell me what you're doing. And hopefully they start coming back with answers that aren't, oh, well, it's really hard. It's like, not to mock or make fun of the person that you spoke to, but I think sometimes with these larger institutions, that tends to be the focus, or like there's a diffusion of responsibility. Well, like, this is a community problem. Like, we're just a school. And it's like, no, if you are going to have a fiduciary duty to protect your students, or some sort of duty to provide your students with safety so they can learn, then you have to look at this problem, because this is something that jeopardizes that safety. So again, kudos to you and all the students across the country who are taking a stance, and I know that your change will be realized. So yeah, thanks so much. And thank you so much for coming back on Black Girl Galaxy for the third episode. Is there anything that you would want to say to, you know, a Black student who is considering going to Queens? Maybe they've read a bunch of the Instagram posts and they might be really worried about their experience. Is there anything that you would say to them?
Yes. I would say that for too long, options for Black academics have been limited due to racism and just people being pushed out of those spaces that they deserve to be in. So when deciding where you're going to go for university, look at the programs and your professional aspirations and decide what's best for you. Don't be afraid to go to a school because it's predominantly white. I say be confident in who you are, and it's a journey for sure. And take up space and be unapologetic about who you are. I know that it's hard and it's a process, but if you have the bandwidth for that, then claiming spaces in these universities is what we need to do.
And that was very beautifully said. And thank you again for sharing your story, being so candid and continuously to do the hard work that's required to make those students who just heard that beautiful talk you gave to them feel a lot more comfortable and safe on campus. Mm-hmm. All right. See you. Well, I guess I won't see you when I get downstairs. Like I said last time, I'll see you Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Hopefully before then. She's back at Queens for context. All right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank really you, appreciate Vanessa. You coming on.
All right, y'all. Sorry, I don't ever say y'all. I don't know why I just did that. But in closing, I will say that universities have the capability to enact change on campus. And yes, solving all of these problems is really hard. But like I said earlier, you can always do better and do more to protect Black women and the racialized students who attend your campuses. So that's it for the second edition of Black on Campus. I am thankful for all of you for listening, for my lovely sister Osaru for always coming on and dropping wisdom. And as always, I want to end this episode off with a message to Black women who are listening right now. Please don't be afraid to make noise in spaces and to ask tough questions of the institutions that you are paying to attend. That's it. And everyone, please subscribe to my podcast and leave a review. And it don't have to be glowing. It doesn't have to be a glowing review. Subtly lit, you know, bright, you know, those work as well. Okay, all right, guys. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks about Massage Noir. Peace out. I also don't say peace out. Why am I doing all these weird things today? This episode of Black Girl Galaxy, like all episodes of Black Girl Galaxy, are products of my experiences and research that I do online. If you would like to have a conversation about something I've said, then please reach out to me on Instagram at Black Girl Galaxy Podcast or visit blackgirlgalaxy.com because yes, your girl's got a website now. So excited. It's so pretty. I'm always open to engage in a dialogue that I think would be helpful for myself and for my listeners. So yeah, that's all. Bye-bye.